from Diamond Pharmacy and Optics. This is Podcast RX with Chris Bender. When he's not on the mic, Chris is a clinical pharmacist with the Office of Pharmacy Therapeutics and Integrated Clinical Services, or Optics. He routinely helps providers in correctional and long-term care facilities make better medication decisions to improve patient care. And we're so happy that he's sharing his expertise with you.
Hoping that today can be a real knowledge booster.
A classic Batman and Robin or Jordan and Pippin type scenario.
A full armamentarium of options that clinicians can choose from.
In this episode, we're diving into a condition that affects over 10 million Americans, but often flies under the radar. Osteoporosis. Following up on last month's discussion on insomnia, we're once again tackling a silent, underdiagnosed condition that has major implications for older adults. Chris breaks down the basics of bone biology, the surprising impact of fractures, and the risk factors that contribute to osteoporosis. From screening guidelines and supplement strategies to the most common pharmacologic treatments, this episode is packed with practical insights for healthcare providers. All this plus medication news, trivia, and an appearance from Chris's dog. I'm Adam Campbell, and thank you for listening.
Welcome to another edition of Podcast RX with Chris Bender. Here we are, smack in the middle of summer already. Chris, hope all is well in your world. I understand you just finished up some vacation time. How you doing today, and how was your time away?
Hey, anytime you can get away with the family is always a good time. Did a little beach trip. You know how it is. Having a toddler, it can be a little bit exhausting at times, but we did get to see the beach, a lot of sun, and I didn't get burnt, so I can't complain. Have you been?
That's a plus. I've been doing great. I got a beach vacation to look forward to coming up here at the beginning of next month. So, that, as you know, life with children, that makes everything go infinitely faster. So that will be here with a snap of the finger, basically. So
exactly. As does the vacation, too. I felt like No sooner did we unpack, we were already packing up.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. A lot of trade-offs there, but you wouldn't trade any of it as a whole, that's for sure. So, yeah, exactly. Looking forward to it. Well, of course, looking forward to always getting our monthly meetup here on the podcast. And, you know, for this episode, we're going to adapt another one of your presentations from the long-term care side. You talked about insomnia the last episode, and this time we're going to get into a discussion about osteoporosis. So definitely another one for the long-term care pros who listen. And, you know, Chris, I don't know if you intended this, but those two topics are both silent and hard to diagnose conditions that kind of fly under the radar in terms of general awareness. So when you were deciding to present on those a couple months back at the conferences, was that your intent to take on something that was a little bit underrated, if you will?
Not necessarily, but it did kind of work out well that way. I guess in a way, these were things that, you know, I guess kind of to your point, were things that I felt weren't being, you know, completely addressed, especially the insomnia one with regard to like the overuse or even in some cases underuse of particular medications and stuff. And obviously in the long-term care space, osteoporosis is so highly represented. So I basically just wanted to go with something that is very prevalent among that population, albeit kind of, you know, like you said, a bit silent and in the general population.
Yeah. And it might seem like a silent or maybe even perhaps bland topic to explore. But after today, as with any treatment of a topic that Chris will give, I think listeners are going to come away with a new appreciation or understanding of it. So, but before that,
at least I hope so.
Yeah. But before that, of course, time for a quick roundup of the medication news of particular importance to institutional providers. Chris, what's happening in the clinic?
Well, dihydroergotamine, or DHE, has actually gotten some love lately with two new products being approved. Now, the first of which is a nasal powder. It's called Atzumi, and it's approved for treatment of acute migraine with or without aura in adults. Now, there's already a generic DHE nasal spray on the market, but no surprise, Atzumi, this particular product showed higher, longer-lasting serum levels when the two were compared directly. Now, the second product is actually an injection, which is called Brachia, which is approved for the treatment of acute migraine, again, with or without aura, but also a cluster headache in adults. Now, in a similar vein, there is already a generic DHE injection solution on the market But this is actually the first DHE injection that is going to be available as an auto injector, which of course allows for self-injection and may make things easier from an individual patient perspective. Now, it should be noted that while DHE has efficacy that is comparable to triptans like sumatriptan and rizatriptan, it's not actually considered first-line therapy for migraines, and this is basically due to the higher incidence of side effects, which most notably include nausea and vasoconstriction. But it can be considered in refractory migraine that hasn't responded to NSAIDs and or triptans. And as for cluster headache, DHE's use is, again, it's reserved for cases refractory, in this case to oxygen therapy as well as triptans. Now, in other news, Nucala gained an expanded indication for adults with inadequately controlled COPD with an eosinophilic phenotype. This joins Dupixent as the second biologic for this indication. Now, this approval was based on results from two clinical trials that showed a 21% and 18% reduction in moderate or severe exacerbations at 1 year when Nucala was added to standard therapy versus placebo. Now, for reference, Dupixent reduced exacerbations by 30% and 34% in its clinical trials. Now, this difference in efficacy may ultimately shape decision-making. However, the smaller reduction seen in the Nucala trials may actually be explained by the fact that its clinical trials included individuals with a lower blood eosinophil count than in the Dupixent trial. So Nucala enrolled individuals with eosinophils greater than or equal to 150, whereas Dupixent enrolled individuals at an eosinophilic level of greater than or equal to 300, meaning it included potentially less severe patients, making it harder to demonstrate as robust of a benefit. So now that being said, this lower threshold and the fact that Nucala is dosed only once monthly compared to every 2 weeks for Dupixent, it may actually make Nucala a somewhat attractive option. And finally, the CDC released their updated HIV non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis, or NPEP, guideline, which focuses on preventing HIV transmission after exposure via injection drug use, sexual contact, or other non-occupational exposures. Now, the CDC recommends HIV NPEP when an exposure has occurred within the past 72 hours that presents a substantial risk for HIV transmission, and of course, the source has HIV without sustained viral suppression, or their viral suppression information isn't known. Now, when NPEP is indicated, it's recommended to initiate it ideally within 24 hours of the exposure, but no later than 72 hours, and you continue that therapy for 28 days. Now, there was a bit of a shakeup in terms of the preferred regimens, because now the preferred regimens are integrase inhibitor-based, or INSTI-based. So the first regimen is going to be bictegravir plus emtricitabine plus tenofovir alafenamide. Now, this is commercially available as a combination pill, Biktarvy. Whereas the other regimen, you can kind of play around with it a little bit more. It's dolutegravir plus tenofovir alafenamide or tenofovir disoproxil fumarate plus emtricitabine or lamivudine. So, like I said, this second regimen allows for a bit more flexibility, particularly from like a cost perspective, considering you could accomplish this by using either Tivicay plus Descovy, Tivicay plus Truvada, or Tivicay plus individual ingredients like tenofovir, disoproxil fumarate, or lamivudine. So I know that's a mouthful there, but I encourage listeners, if they would like, the guideline is listed in the show notes. And they have a nice little chart there that kind of lays these out.
And we'll be right back.
Everyone knows that pharmacists dispense medication, but the clinical pharmacists in Diamond Pharmacy's optics team dispense more potent resources, information, and education. The optics pharmacists are frontline medication experts for Diamond's many institutional partners. Whether you work as a provider in corrections or long-term care, The Optix team is standing by to answer your on-demand medication questions. But Optix is far more than a drug information hotline. They also create proactive knowledge resources like webinars and this podcast to keep partners up to speed with the latest drug developments. And they help providers to better manage costs and therapeutic outcomes with their in-house medication surveillance monitoring program. Learn more about the Optix team by going to diamondpharmacy.com and clicking the clinical support tab. See pharmacy care more clearly with Optix. Let's get back to Podcast RX.
Okay, as noted at the top of the show, today we're going to delve into another topic developed by Chris for a long-term care audience, and that's osteoporosis. Now, when I think of osteoporosis, my brain immediately goes to, I think first of women, older women, and supplement commercials. And while there's definitely some truth reflected in that half-baked take, if you will, the bottom line is that this is a condition affecting over 10 million Americans. And as we talked about earlier, it's a silent condition too. So Chris, when we're focusing on osteoporosis numbers, what are some other figures about its impact that might surprise people?
Yeah, so I think what often gets overlooked with osteoporosis is just how debilitating fractures can be. I know it's easy to kind of write off a fracture as simply an unfortunate inconvenience that will eventually heal. But in reality, some fractures, particularly those of the hip, can actually be life-altering. So for instance, fewer than one half of fracture patients actually regain their pre-fracture baseline activities of daily living, and one-fourth regain their baseline level of social function. So that could be clearly debilitating from a social aspect and just from like doing your normal day-to-day aspect, and that can take a huge toll on individuals, both physically and emotionally. But what's worse is that nearly one-quarter of hip fracture patients over the age of 50 actually die the following year. So this can be a very, very severe situation as well.
Severe indeed. And so, Chris, if you could explain quickly what exactly osteoporosis is, how it develops, and which parts of the body are the most vulnerable.
Yeah, so the skeleton is actually quite an interesting organ in that it's constantly undergoing a process known as remodeling, which is where old bone is being broken down and new bone is being built. Now, this is essential for maintaining bone health and adapting to mechanical stresses of life. So to do this, it relies on two different cells. So first are the osteoblasts, which are the ones that build, and the others are the osteoclasts, and those are the ones that break down the bone. Now, these cells maintain a delicate balance throughout most of our lives. However, osteoporosis starts to develop when bone resorption by the osteoclasts starts to exceed bone formation by the osteoblasts, which ultimately results in decreased bone mass, deterioration of the microarchitecture of the bone, and then ultimately it ultimately ends in an increased fracture risk, particularly in the spine, the hip, and the wrist. Now, this imbalance happens naturally because aging actually leads to reduced osteoblast or building function, but it is actually accelerated in postmenopausal women because of estrogen. Because of the estrogen deficiency, which occurs at that time, which actually increases osteoclast activity. So we kind of have this, you know, postmenopausal women have this kind of unfair disadvantage where aging, you know, aging is predisposing it to you anyway, or predisposing you to osteoporosis anyway. And then that estrogen drop kind of like adds fuel to the fire.
What are some of the more prominent risk factors for developing osteoporosis?
There are actually quite a lot. So there are some general ones. There are some that you can't change, like having a family history of osteoporosis, being female sex, increasing age, or being of white or Asian race. Whereas there are other factors that you can change, like cigarette smoking, excessive alcohol, insufficient calcium or vitamin D, or leading a sedentary lifestyle. Now, additionally, some medical conditions can actually increase the risk as well. There are a lot of them, but just to be brief, these many of which include rheumatoid arthritis, certain types of cancers, inflammatory bowel disease, diabetes, hyperthyroidism, COPD, as well as kidney and liver diseases. And then finally, certain medications can increase risk. Again, there are a lot of these as well. But kind of the biggest players would be certain anticonvulsants like phenytoin and valproic acid. You also have lithium, methotrexate, pioglitazone, proton pump inhibitors, SSRIs, and chronic high-dose steroids.
Let's talk about the diagnostic criteria. What does that look like? And when should screening ideally start to take place?
So general screening should be performed for women 65 years and older and men 70 years and older. But additionally, younger women and younger men with risk factors should be screened as well. So this would include women 50 to 64 years and men 50 to 69 years. As well as there's also a third category of individuals who should be screened. This includes any adult age 50 years and older with a history of adult age fracture. So we have kind of a fairly broad net, but the most general one is 65 years and older for women and 70 years and older for men if they don't have any risk factors. Now, the primary screening tool that we use is a DEXA scan, which reports two different scores, those being a Z score and a T score. But for all intents and purposes, the T score is the most commonly used. Now, individuals with a T score of -1 or higher, they're considered to have normal bone mineral density. Whereas individuals with a T score between -1 and -2.5 are considered to have low bone mass, also known as osteopenia. And those lower than -2.5 are considered to have overt osteoporosis. Now, it's important to note that some individuals with low bone mass or osteopenia may actually still require treatment as if they had overt osteoporosis based on clinical risk factors, which is why individuals with osteopenia should undergo further screening with a FRAX tool, that's F-R-A-X, to calculate their 10-year probability of either hip fracture or major osteoporotic factor or osteoporotic fracture. And basically what this does is it spits out a percentage. So individuals with a 10-year risk of 3% or more for hip fracture and or 20% or more for major osteoporotic fracture, these individuals would meet diagnostic criteria as well. But in addition to these two groups, there are actually two other groups that meet diagnostic criteria as well. And these would include those with a hip or vertebral fracture, regardless of their T-score, and those with osteopenia who experience an osteoporotic fracture. So from this, you can kind of see there are many different ways by which you can qualify for osteoporosis treatment and diagnosis. But it's a good thing because you want to catch this early in individuals in order to preserve their bone mineral density for the longest amount of time that you can.
Well, you can't have a discussion about osteoporosis without mentioning vitamins and mineral deficiencies, right? What, when, and how much should people start taking them to get ahead of osteoporosis?
Yeah, so just to be clear to our listeners, so like while calcium and vitamin D deficiencies can increase your risk of developing osteoporosis, there is actually no evidence to show that supplementing beyond the normal recommended daily intake, that it can prevent osteoporosis. So when it comes to vitamins and minerals, what we're really talking about are recommendations for those with an already established diagnosis of osteoporosis. So what are those? So individuals with osteoporosis are recommended to maintain sufficient intake of both calcium and vitamin D, of course. So for calcium, this means 1,000 milligrams of elemental calcium per day for men 50 to 70 years, and 1,200 milligrams of elemental calcium per day for women 51 years and older and men 71 years and older. I don't like thinking about things that way. I typically, just for my own simplicity, I just typically think of 1,200 milligrams per day for everyone. Now, calcium is prevalent in many foods that we consume, like dairy products, dark greens, and fortified foods like orange juice. However, even though it's pretty ubiquitous, most individuals don't actually get enough from their diet. So supplementation is going to be recommended at that point. Now, there are two main products available over the counter. These include calcium carbonate and calcium citrate. Now, the main difference to remember between the two is that the amount of elemental calcium they contain is different. So calcium carbonate contains 40% elemental calcium, and calcium citrate contains 21%. So you need to be mindful whenever you're looking over the counter, because some products specify the exact amount of elemental calcium it contains, whereas others do not. At which point it's kind of annoying because then you have to do a little bit of math. Both work equally well for supplementation. However, calcium carbonate requires an acidic environment for absorption, and it's best when taken with food, whereas calcium citrate is absorbed equally well, regardless of the stomach circumstances. So I personally think it's it's kind of like guideline recommended, but it's a calcium citrate is a better choice for individuals with inflammatory bowel disease, absorption disorders, and those on proton pump inhibitors. So that's why I kind of just unilaterally recommend that calcium citrate across the board, because you don't have to actively think if a patient has those underlying conditions, and it's an easier shot in the dark to take. Now for vitamin D, the recommended daily intake is 800 to 1000 units per day. Now, vitamin D actually isn't that prevalent in our diet. It's mainly found in fortified foods like orange juice and fortified dairy products. So individuals are often going to require supplementation. Now, there are two main products available most are probably familiar with. These are vitamin D2, also known as ergocalciferol, and vitamin D3, which is also known as cholecalciferol. Now, both of them are effective, but vitamin D3 is actually a bit more potent, and studies have shown that it may be more effective at reducing fracture risk based on clinical trials. And then the last one is interesting. There's vitamin K2, which, despite not being mentioned in the guidelines, has actually been growing in popularity in recent years with actual evidence to support its use. So essentially, vitamin K2 helps to improve calcium uptake, and studies have shown improvements in the lumbar, forearm, and vertebral bone mineral density, with some decreased markers of bone turnover. And it also appears that vitamin K2 is safe. Clinical studies haven't shown any significant adverse reactions, and unlike vitamin K, vitamin K2 doesn't actually affect blood clotting. So it was one of those things that I was initially skeptical of, but after doing a little bit more research, I have come around to the concept, and I don't overtly recommend it, but I also don't tell people not to take it as well, simply because it's not in the guidelines yet. But if people were to take vitamin K2, the typical dose that they use in clinical trials is 100 micrograms once a day.
Well, before we get into medications, pharmacologic recommendations, are there any other non-pharmacologic interventions, recommendations that you could use to manage osteoporosis?
Yeah, of course. So, as we had mentioned with some of the modifiable risk factors earlier, if an individual smokes or drinks alcohol in excess, they should obviously be encouraged to stop. Additionally, exercise is pretty key here. So obviously, as long as it's tailored to the individual's ability, we don't want to put excessive strain on their bones. So obviously we're not going to be talking about powerlifting or anything here, but a good exercise program is essential. And one that includes components of weight bearing, such as, walking, climbing stairs, muscle strengthening, like using free weights or resistance bands, but also incorporating like balance and flexibility exercises. So things like Tai Chi, yoga, and stretching. And finally, it's important to minimize the risk of falls, particularly at home, but also too if in the institution. So we want to minimize the use of sedating or hypotensive medications. We want to minimize having obstacles or loose rugs laying around. And of course, if individuals were to need them, rely on the use of walkers or canes, as well as wearing supportive shoes can help.
So, Chris, as you did with the previous episode on insomnia, can you talk about the prescription options then for osteoporosis treatment? And I do realize there's not enough time in this episode to really go in everything in depth. So perhaps maybe a look at the most common agents?
Yeah, I'll try to hit the high points and keep everything a little bit more brief here because like you said, there's a lot of different, there are a lot of different treatment classes. So we'll kind of get to everything. Pretty briefly here. So there are four main treatment options, okay? With the main difference between them being whether they maintain bone mineral density, I'll be referring to them as anti-resorptives, or if they increase bone mineral density, aka anabolics. Now, this distinction between the drugs is important because moderate risk patients are typically treated with anti-resorptives. mainly because these are more affordable, they've been around longer, and they can be used for longer durations of time. However, what we're seeing now is high-risk patients, like those with very low T-scores or very high FRAX scores, or even those with recent fractures or higher volume of fractures, these individuals are often treated initially with an anabolic agent because you want to build their bone density up before switching them to an anti-resorptive to maintain their gains. So the first class we have is the bisphosphonate class. Now, this is the oldest and probably the most familiar class of drugs. These include alendronate, ibandronate, ricedronate, and zoledronic acid. They're all available in a variety of formulations. So we have tablets, oral solutions, and even IV solutions. And depending on the agent, some can be given daily, weekly, monthly, or even yearly. Now, these are anti-resorptive agents, so they maintain bone mineral density. Now, generally speaking, alendronate is the most commonly used, and it's given either as 10 milligrams once daily or 70 milligrams once weekly. But zoledronic acid is a great option for those with adherence or administration concerns, because it can be given as a 5 milligram IV infusion once yearly. So I kind of like to recommend that a lot for those types of patients. Now, the biggest issue with oral bisphosphonates is GI irritation, which is why they require special administration. It's recommended to swallow tablets whole on an empty stomach with plain water, and you got to remain upright without eating or drinking anything for at least 30 minutes. So that can be kind of difficult for a lot of patients, particularly if they have like mobility issues, issues with standing and whatnot. And they also carry a small risk of atypical femur fracture and osteonecrosis of the jaw. Now, when they're used, bisphosphonates are typically used for 5 years, but they can be used for an additional 5 years if patients are deemed to still be at a high fracture risk at that time. So something unique about this class is their long half-lives, which means that when a bisphosphonate is discontinued, it doesn't need to be immediately followed by another medication. So there are scenarios where patients can be treated for 5 years, and if they're deemed a low risk, they can actually go without medication while being reassessed every 2 to 3 years thereafter. And this concept is commonly referred to as a quote-unquote drug holiday. Now, unfortunately, the same can't be said for the next classes since they don't have the same long-lasting effect. So moving forward, when we discuss these next classes, anytime one of them are discontinued, it needs to be immediately followed by a different medication to avoid losing any of the gains that the individual may have made. So next, we have the RANK ligand inhibitor, which there's only one. It's denosumab. And this one has both anti-resorptive and anabolic properties. It's given as a 60 milligram subcutaneous injection every 6 months, has to be given by a healthcare provider. Providers are also required to counsel patients about the risks associated with denosumab, which include dermatologic reactions, hypocalcemia, infections, musculoskeletal pain, atypical femur fracture, as well as osteonecrosis of the jaw. Now, denosumab can be used for up to 10 years, but again, once discontinued, it must be followed by another medication to maintain that bone density. The next class are the parathyroid hormone analogs. We have abaloparatide and teriparatide. Now, these agents are strictly anabolic. Now, despite this fact, these agents haven't been shown to reduce hip fractures, unlike all the other main classes, which can kind of be a drawback to their use because that's the main one that we want to, kind of the big scary one that we want to prevent, obviously. Other drawbacks to their use include they require daily subcutaneous administration, as well as their tolerability. So common adverse reactions include nausea, gastritis, orthostatic hypotension, which can be particularly problematic because we want to prevent the risk of falling in individuals. So orthostatic hypotension can be a risk factor for falls, but they can also cause dizziness and headache. But additionally, because these agents purely help to build bone, they shouldn't be used in individuals at risk for osteosarcoma or cancer of the bone. Kind of makes sense. You don't want, if patients have a history or risk factors for their bone growing too much, you don't want to put them on a drug that's going to cause their bones to grow. So this would include individuals with Paget's disease, those who've undergone prior skeletal radiation, or those, like I said, with a history of bone metastases or malignancies. Now, these agents can be used for up to 2 years, at which point they would be switched over to an anti-resorptive agent. And finally, we have the newest agent, romosozumab, which is a sclerostin inhibitor. Now, this agent is anabolic and, to a lesser extent, anti-resorptive. It's given as a monthly subcutaneous injection by a healthcare provider. Now, unlike previous classes, which were approved for both males and females, romosozumab is only approved for use in females. So that's kind of a limiting factor in this product. It also carries a box warning regarding an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular death. Now, this is because in the ARCH trial, the incidence rate of cardiovascular events was 2.5% with romosozumab versus 1.9% with alendronate. More recent studies, however, have actually shown that the risk with romosozumab is similar to that seen with denosumab and teriparatide. Regardless, caution is warranted in those with established cardiovascular disease. Now, romosozumab has also been associated with hypocalcemia, atypical femur fracture, and osteonecrosis of the jaw. And one other limitation is that it has to be limited to, its use has to be limited to 1 year. And that's actually because it's the effectiveness of its bone forming effect actually starts to wane after a year. So it's very short lived. And at which point at that 1 year mark, patients would be switched to an anti-resorptive agent. Now, you know, there are other treatments such as calcitonin, estrogen, and selective estrogen receptor modulators, but their use is a lot more niche. So, of course, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into detail. But I would like to quickly touch on the concepts of osteonecrosis of the jaw and atypical femur fracture, because these adverse events, even though they're very rare, are what drive patients away from therapy. So I think it's important to put things into perspective. So these events can happen with bisphosphonates, denosumab, and to a lesser extent, romosozumab. However, if 10,000 people were treated for 5 years, one person would develop osteonecrosis of the jaw and 16 would develop atypical femur fracture based on estimates. Now, conversely, if those same 10,000 people went without treatment, 5,000 would suffer a fracture. So the benefits vastly outweigh the risks. But of course, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be mindful of them. While there is no prevention against atypical femur fracture, the risk of ONJ can be reduced by maintaining good oral hygiene and regular dental care. So individuals on these drugs don't need to fear the dentist. In fact, they should be more frequently seeing the dentist just to make sure they keep good oral hygiene.
That was a really great explanation of the risk involved there, just to show how rare it is. I'm glad you did that. Yeah. Going back to romosozumab. Romosozumab, thank you. Why is it only approved for females?
I believe that in the clinical trial, that was the only study population.
Okay.
So I don't think it's been studied in males, and that's likely the reason why.
Right. Okay, so now that you've given us that great high-level overview of each of the agents, as we always do, we try to tie it back to what we do here at Diamond. So let's look at osteoporosis management within institutional settings, like long-term care, of course, and maybe to a lesser extent, corrections. What are some common barriers to diagnosis or treatment in these settings? And ultimately, what are the strategies that caregivers and providers can adopt?
Yeah, well, osteoporosis is more front of mind in long-term care, but not as much in correction. So from the correctional side, I'd say that general awareness and screening is probably lacking. You also have to consider the correctional setting. In the jail setting, it's more transient and kind of skews younger. So the need for screening probably isn't there. But the prison setting, where you may have older individuals, there is probably more of a need for screening. So standard age-based screening protocols would probably be beneficial in that environment. But another thing that is often lacking is a detailed medical history, which can influence our treatment decisions. So trying to obtain a complete medical history, just to get that history of risk factors and fracture history, I think that could really help. Now, the biggest barrier from the long-term care side is probably more of the logistical perspective, namely those patients that have a hard time swallowing or adhering to the recommended administration for bisphosphonates. So for these patients, it would be, or as I typically recommend, would be to switch to IV zoledronic acid or the subcutaneous denosumab.
So, Chris, as a clinical pharmacist advising providers in these institutional settings, what would you say that your number one piece of advice, clinical pearl, et cetera, would be relative to treating osteoporosis?
Yeah, so we've long relied on bisphosphonates as the first therapy for nearly all patients with osteoporosis. And of course, this is likely driven by insurance policies as they're the oldest and the cheapest. So step therapy is very much a thing here. However, higher risk patients are starting off at a lower bone density than their less severe counterparts. So it makes sense to build them up first and then preserve their bone density after that. So what I would suggest is don't be afraid, if possible, to use an anabolic agent first for these patients, followed by an anti-resorptive, kind of be a little bit more aggressive with them to put them in a better starting position.
Well, that's a good way to put a bow on that discussion of osteoporosis, and we're going to be right back. We're not done talking about bisphosphonates just yet.
In the realm of corrections health, not all electronic health records are created equally. Sapphire EHR is a comprehensive, cloud-based electronic health record designed specifically for correctional health providers. Since 2011, Sapphire has worked one-on-one with healthcare staff in jails and prisons to develop and refine a suite of features and modules to manage total inmate patient care. From MedPass to dental care to documentation of lab results and creating custom forms, Sapphire's correction-specific features can be scaled to meet the needs of the largest correctional facilities down to the smallest local jails. And it's all backed up by 100% in-house hosting, training, and support with a 24/7 help desk. Get a closer look at the Corrections EHR deployed in over 400 facilities across 36 states and territories. Visit www.sapphire-health.com and schedule a demo today. Sapphire EHR, cloud-based, compatible, correction-specific electronic health records. Now back to Podcast RX with Chris Bender.
Well, as I said ahead of the break, we're not done talking about the bisphosphonates because there's actually some really interesting trivia associated with them. Chris?
Well, did you know that the most common osteoporosis drug class was initially used as a pipe cleaner? That's right, the bisphosphonates. The first line treatment for most osteoporosis patients were first used in industrial applications. Initially synthesized in Germany in the 1860s, the bisphosphonates were used most notably to remove calcium scale from industrial pipes. Now, you might wonder, how exactly do you go from anti-corrosive pipe cleaner to bone-strengthening wonder drug? Well, consider the calcium connection. They were handy pipe cleaners because they would chelate calcium and inhibit calcium carbonate precipitation. In the human body, the bisphosphonates inhibit the formation and aggregation and slow the dissolution of calcium phosphate crystals, which contributes to bone resorption. It was only in the late 1960s that scientists first demonstrated the biological capabilities of the bisphosphonates. The first bisphosphonates for clinical use, etidronate and quadrinate, were developed in the 1970s and 80s. Today, the bisphosphonates are one of the most powerful drug classes deployed against not just osteoporosis, but bone diseases across the board from myeloma to Legg-Perthes disease.
That was a great way to end the entire discussion about osteoporosis. Again, I do hope people got a lot out of that today. I certainly did. It was good for you to do that in-depth explanation and clear up a lot of misconceptions that I myself had about osteoporosis. So thank you for another wonderful discussion.
Yeah, of course. Glad to do it. Hopefully that wasn't too deep on the medications. There's a lot going on with those, but I think we kind of hit those high points there.
Yeah, I would agree. So again, if you like what we do here, Podcast RX with Chris Bender, we do hope that you are following the show where you listen to podcasts. Give us a follow, write us a review if you can, help us get the show out there. So we do want to make sure that we're building that audience out. Do share it with a friend. Chris, I understand you were talking to a former colleague recently who was checking the show out and had good things to say. So yeah, we're just trying to get the show out there.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm hoping it also sounds better based on that feedback. that we got from him. Also, I hear your dog.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. She's telling me to wrap up here. So.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. Well, in line with the wishes of Chris's dog, we will wrap up here. But again, thanks so much, Chris, for talking about osteoporosis today. We'll be back next month and looking forward to it.
Hey, likewise. You take care.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Podcast RX features conversations with healthcare professionals. The statements and opinions discussed herein are for informational purposes only. This podcast should not be considered professional medical advice and should not be used as the substitute for the advice of an appropriately qualified and licensed healthcare professional. Therefore, listeners must not rely on the statements made herein.
Podcast RX is a production of Diamond Pharmacy Services. Find our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy podcasts. And where possible, please rate and review. If you'd like to get in touch with the show directly, shoot us an email at podcastrx@diamondpharmacy.com. Thank you again for your support.